Thank you. For those who know my work and know me, you know I'm new to engineering education. But I started to lobby at the university with which I am only informally affiliated, University of Arizona, for the extension of some degree of general education courses about engineering. And that turned out to be a failed effort. And out of its failure came my determination to find out both why it failed, why I couldn't sell this idea. I thought it was worth liberal arts students, especially those in history, social science, pre-business, pre-law, to know a little bit of an answer to two questions. What do engineers do, and how do they think about what they do? And I found it was impossible to initiate this because of issues of size of classes and FTEs and my own lack of status in engineering. So instead, I hooked up with my old friend and found out about this program and was very pleased to be included as your rapporteur and also as a speaker. So I am new to engineering education, very new, perhaps a year since. But I am not new to the issues that you're talking about because of my 30 years of work trying to open science and mathematics to the non-traditional student. And without selling my books, I'll just tell you how I see the intersection of my work and your goals. The first is the whole mention of the two cultures. I mean, clearly that's the problem right here, is we have students who are steeped in one culture, either unwilling to or unable to appreciate that of another culture, and it's two-sided. Believe me, it's not just engineers resisting liberal arts, it's liberal arts students resisting anything remotely like engineering. And the minorities and women issue I've dealt with even longer than I have with science and math. I was an active feminist in the movement, which is now about 40 years old, and picked as my topics, or was assigned, you might say, by the revolutionaries, the field of math anxiety. First it was math avoidance, that's the way it was formulated, and because of the feminist analysis of how girls are shaped by the culture and by the people who are significant in their lives, including 14-year-old boys who know quite well what is normal for girls and what is not normal for girls, they tend to begin as math avoiders and then in time become anxious, actually, about math. My contribution, apart from a best-selling book, which was helped support my other activities. The book was called Overcoming Math Anxiety. My contribution was to postulate, even without neuroscience background, that the problem for girls isn't a difference in their mental capacity or their the sorting out of their spatial visualization, a lot of which research, incidentally, is very biased, but rather it's a signal-to-noise ratio. That when the average untroubled person encounters a new concept in mathematics, they can bring the full force of their curiosity and their capability to bear on learning it. But if you are struggling with an identity or with trying to please your mother or please your boyfriend, or you've never seen any female doing mathematics in the public world, you will have a lot of noise, as you all in physics define it, going on in your head, and the signal will be depleted. So I argued that we have no evidence, none whatsoever, that girls are capable of doing mathematics. All we know is that they are operating in a very thick environment of interference. And so my solution as an educator, I was then at a formerly men's college, Wesleyan University in Connecticut, was to invent a math clinic. A math anxiety clinic to which girls, and as it turned out, 50% of the takers were boys, because they're not without trouble with math, were invited to come and talk about and then deal with their avoidance and anxiety of mathematics. And without going into great detail as to what we did, it will interest you to realize that the first question we asked them, and we being people I hired were math teachers of some quality, and therapists or psychologists, the first question we asked them was, what was the last concept in mathematics that you really understood, on which you would stake your life, so to speak? and it was something like addition of fractions for a group of high-achieving, high SAT students at an elite college in New England in 1974. So I moved from that to the clinic, wrote about the clinic, wrote this book, Overcoming Math Anxiety, which had, a provocative chapter called Mathematics and Sex, by which I really meant mathematics and gender, and then moved on. Almost immediately after the success of the book, and this is a private meeting, so I'm going to be very personal, a friend at a college in physics thought that he could catch the tiger by the tail and wanted to write a book called Science Anxiety and asked me to write an introduction. Well, we've all been in that situation. And I dutifully wrote the introduction, but I thought he was dead wrong because the math anxiety we'd identified occurs in the elementary school years when you have to go up to the blackboard and turn your back to the class and expose your ignorance. And science, as far as I could tell, and from my own memory, was presented as fun from, you know, K through 6 or 7. And why would science learning construct any kind of anxiety? It didn't make any sense to me. But it forced me to ask myself another question. We've all been there in the research we do. And that was, well, if it's not anxiety, what is it that keeps young people of intellectual capability, including myself, looking back, from choosing science, more science, and majoring in science? And that led to another several years of research, which I think is going to be relevant to what you're doing if you want to ever see the book. It's called They're Not Dumb, They're Different. I encountered, as I asked questions about science avoidance, and that's all I called it was science avoidance, a deep prejudice on the part of science teachers and science scholars. And it if you ask them the simple question, what makes science hard, which was my question, their answer is essentially, science is hard because it's hard. And in the world I inhabit, that's called the tautological explanation. It really isn't rooted in any kind of reality. So I had to get at, and this was a very serious research problem, I had to get at the question, what makes science hard? If it's not hard because it's hard. And then I had to do what you do in research. I had to set up an experiment in which I removed all the variables but one. But what are the many variables that might make science hard for a college student? It's that they are immature, that they don't know how to study anything very efficiently. They have sort of blocks and they don't have much confidence. So I decided to remove all the variables from that equation except newness to the field. And picked first a group of University of Chicago faculty who were willing, because their senior administrators suggested they do this, to come to a session where a very good member of their faculty taught a short segment of a course about this, I don't know, sophomore level maybe, in physics called Waves in Elastic Media. And he presented it to a group who were, in my experimental model, indistinguishable from himself. They were mature, they were good learners, they have high confidence, they like and are curious about new subjects, and there they were in class. And their assignment was to try as hard as they could to comprehend this lesson, just one lesson, and then write as they listened, I had a divided page, write on the right side of the page what they were experiencing, what was making this subject hard. So my question was posed to a group of people who could sort out by self-analysis what it was that made it hard. And their answers were phenomenally interesting, and that article was published in Physics Today with a lot of interest and acclaim. And I continued it in chemistry. We went around to other universities, other faculty, and looked at entropy. The lesson was entropy. I looked for lesson topics that did not presume prior knowledge, but were knotty and complex. And we got tremendous feedback from these faculty who found it fun and entertaining, and they told us what the difficulties were. And then I was criticized, as one always is.
These faculty were not science faculty.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. They were from theology and literature. In fact, the theologian made my favorite comment. He said of a demonstration, a physics class filled with demonstrations, he said, well, there's certainly a lot more instruments and things in a physics lecture than in theology. And that's the kind of feedback we got. So I was then criticized, you always are. This wasn't a fair test because they weren't in labs, they weren't taking exams, they were just sitting sort of passively in a lecture. And I found somebody willing to pay 7 graduate students in fields other than science who were expert learners, very successful, very confident young people, to sit in semester long in intro physics or intro chemistry, which they'd never taken at college, and go to labs and take exams. And then write, as they went through this, write commentary from which I could weave a tale, and that's what this book was. They're Not Dumb, They're Different. And it was extremely well received. I have to comment that the faculty in the sciences, and I assume in engineering, are open. You tell them something they didn't think about or they didn't know, and they are truly grateful. And I'm not sure that would be true on my side of the campus, but that's my experience. So that book rendered a whole new approach to the teaching of science. And I moved on from that, just moving quickly, to talk to another subject that I have had some experience with. It's not only decoding the difficulties and trying to open them up, but also making change in universities. I then was funded to take a dozen or so university programs and try to track why change had succeeded or not succeeded. And that book was called Revitalizing Undergraduate Science, Why Some Things Work and Most Don't. And that brought me, I guess Norman knows that book, that brought me into some very interesting places where there was always an innovator, always a reformer. And when I would knock on the door of a department, physics, chemistry, biology, and say, I'm here to track the changes and improvements you've made, they'd say, oh, you want to talk to Joe over there. He's our change agent. And, of course, you don't have to be told that doesn't work. Joe went on sabbatical. The changes disappeared. Joe retired, and he was his work was sort of forgotten. So I postulated that there was another model for making change and had a wonderful time meeting very wonderful people. There are about 11 examples in cases. And finally, for this talk, the last area of intersection of your goals and my goals is starting a new program altogether. In 1995, when there was some worry about the PhDs and there was some loss of job possibilities for PhDs, I and 2 collaborators did a set of interviews and questionnaires of failed PhDs who had failed to get jobs. And we found them to be frustrated, of course, and angry, but happy to talk by writing answers. And the most interesting question we had on our the book was called Rethinking Science as a Career. But that was not what we started out to do. That was the result of what we found out. We asked them an interesting question. You never know what's going to take off, but this one did. Now that you know you probably won't get an academic position, and it was physical science in this instance, the 4 physical sciences, what do you wish you had studied? Now that you know you're going to have to reconfigure yourself for a different kind of job in a different arena, what do you wish you had studied? And the answers were fulsome and many. You know, everything from more computer science to a foreign language to, you know, on and on, not unlike what you all are thinking about adding to the engineering curriculum. And when we looked up, 3 of us, from this questionnaire, having ticked off all these answers, we looked at each other and said with one voice, this is a curriculum. They are asking for something in addition to, not other than, but in addition to what we teach them in the sciences and mathematics. Out of that came a new master's degree. I mean, here I am where I was then, where you are now, a concept of a new master's degree called a PSM, a Professional Science Master's, which would be reserved only for science and mathematics majors. You couldn't have done environmental studies and qualify. That would give them additional work, 2 more years of non-research-oriented science and mathematics, plus everything from regulatory affairs to business fundamentals to patent law, introduction to, et cetera. And that those programs now, and that's why I wanted to tell you this story, there are 322 such programs around the country. From 1997 on, when they began to be funded and encouraged, until now, in 120 universities. The PSM, we call it, celebrated its milestone, its 300th program affiliation, last November. So where does that, and I hope I will hear from you, where does that all take us? I think it should be a positive message. It's possible. It's possible to invent something. And believe me, selling the master's degree in the sciences is uphill. The master's degree has a very negative reputation as being a failed PhD. And why did we choose to make it a master's? We chose to make it a master's because my background is in political science. And when you are trying to innovate or change, you want to go where the resistance is not. Well, there would be no resistance to developing a new master's degree in the sciences, in the STEM fields, because everybody diminished it. They thought it had no value. So they wouldn't fight us. If we'd come up with a new doctoral, and there have been examples of doctorate in chemistry, you get shut down. So we took an arena in which there was no resistance, basically, and we created this course counting on two things. One, a foundation. Very important to have the foundation giving us startup funds for all of these programs. And two, that students would vote with their feet for a program for which they had to pay tuition. Mind you, they weren't on a research grant. They had to pay tuition, that they would pay tuition, they would see it as an investment with a payoff. So the program, I didn't come here to talk about it in detail, but it consists of advanced course training and an internship and these plus courses, we call them professional skills courses, and an opportunity to go out and work. And I've just completed my last study for Sloan, and that is a study of the graduates. We have 6,000 graduates. We had a sample of about 3,300 and tracked where they're working, what they're earning, and what they're doing. So that's a model for you. I mean, it wasn't undergraduate, it was graduate, but it was related to the science. And I hope the message is that you can do this